This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Admit it, there is a movie sitting on the back shelf somewhere in your house. It's a movie that got awful reviews, and it is one that you tell your friends and neighbors you bought out of the bargain pile just for fun. Secretly, you love it. And it's okay. It's okay, because sometimes the corny punchlines or the over-the-top characters and ridiculous action scenes are irresistible. You know they're bad, but something keeps you coming back to those flicks, and we keep to ourselves. One person's flop is another person's guilty pleasure. So we're hearing your confessions of guilty pleasures on Movies on the Radio today on The State of Things. With me, as always, Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you, Frank.
And Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
So, Laura, let's talk about this, because this is kind of a funny category. I mean, we're not really talking about bad movies here. It's guilty pleasure. So how did you interpret our category?
Well, there are certain things that you wish to enjoy in the privacy of your own home and will not, especially while having intellectual conversations with your friends, confess to. And so these guilty pleasures are still in a very important part of your film-going life, whether they're because they're associated with a particular time in your life, or maybe there's a certain actor or actress in it that you identify very strongly with. So it has a great personal meaning to you, and the world's opinion does not matter.
And Marcia, we're going to start with one that is widely considered a bad movie. This one, there's no doubt.
Yeah, so we're going to start today with an Ed Wood film. And Ed Wood is affectionately known perhaps as the worst director in the history of American cinema. And he's much loved by many. Some people know him only through Tim Burton's very adoring biopic about him, in which Donnie Depp played Ed Wood. But I believe we're going to be listening to something from Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.
I saw a flying saucer.
Saucer? You mean the kind from up there?
Yeah, its counterpart. It was shaped like a huge cigar.
One thing, sure. Inspector Clay's dead, murdered, and somebody's responsible.
What do you think will be the next obstacle the Earth people will put in our way?
Well, as long as they can think, we'll have our problems. But those whom we're using cannot think. They are the dead, brought to a simulated life by our electrode guns. You know, it's an interesting thing when you consider the Earth people who can think are so frightened by those who cannot. The dead. Well, our ship should be regenerated. We better get started.
My friend, you have seen this incident based on sworn testimony. Can you prove that it didn't happen? Perhaps on your way home, someone will pass you in the dark, and you will never know it, for they will be from outer space. God help us in the future.
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah. So first off, Ed Wood is a very prolific writer and director. So this is not somebody who did some kind of one-off, quote unquote, bad film. He made a lot of films, and they're really interesting in their own right. He did this one film called Glen or Glenda in 1953. That's about transvestism and transsexuals. I mean, these are not subjects that were being taken up by the Hollywood studios, but these are very, 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 very low-budget films. They are very artless. The special effects, I mean, you can't hear them, but you can imagine them. They're terrible, you know. So, but it's, you know, but they're fun. Sometimes artlessness is pleasurable. And
he has so much enthusiasm for making his film. Yeah. And he gave his actors that same kind of enthusiasm. One thing that's so deadening about a lot of indie films where people think they're being very smart and edgy is they're trying to act in a realistic fashion. Mm-hmm. And it just takes all the air, you know, out of whatever they're doing. There's a lot to be said for overacting. I would see an overacted movie as opposed to an underacted one in a second.
You know, and he was making films about, I mean, kind of expressly exploitation films in the 60s. He was doing things like Five Loose Women and Nympho Cycler. I've never seen it, but I can only imagine what
mean,
that one's like.
Like a Nympho Recycler? Cycler?
Cycler, that's all I know. I'm sure somebody out there has seen that in
Well, Ed Wood, I mean, first of all, you called him the worst director in Hollywood, but obviously not because he produced so many films. The worst director in Hollywood produced one film and never was heard of again.
Right,
Ed produced a million of these things, which were pretty much 88 minutes of backstory and 2 minutes of half-baked philosophy and theology, right? I mean, it was something and morals.
And they didn't cost. I mean, the bottom line is this. You know, there are people who spend millions of dollars making bad films, and Ed Wood spent, you know, $50 making films that people – I mean, he made profits on these films. So you could sell them in this kind of alternative market that was not the mainstream distribution system and actually be profitable, and people had a good time.
And another director who did that was William Castle.
Yes.
Who made a lot of cheapy movies. And there's one in particular, The Tingler.
The Tingler.
Which has an LSD trip in it and many other, you know, really exciting subplots, along with Vincent Price, one of the great overactors of all time.
Well, sci-fi was certainly an important genre when it came to guilty pleasures. We're going to hear this film from a listener about a sci-fi guilty pleasure of the 1980s.
My name's Barry Webb. I'm from Brown Summit, North Carolina. My favorite bad movie is Dune, directed by David Lynch. The reason I'm so attracted to this movie and watched it maybe 50 times in the last 30 years is because I just find it so funny.
The Duke will die before these eyes, and he'll know that it is I, Van Vladimir Harkonnen, who encompasses his doom.
It's obvious that there was no intended humor in the movie from the director's point of view, but it turned out the exact opposite. I would have to say that my favorite scene would be at the end when Sting is jumping around and saying, I will kill him. I will kill him!
So pretty much you will kill him, I think. Go by the soundtrack by Toto.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those films that was like very anticipated, very talked about, and then ended up just being catastrophic. I've never heard anyone say they've seen it 50 times. I'm sure there are others, but that is extraordinary in and of itself. Oh. And when I was yesterday thinking about this, and I was looking up old movie reviews from when some of these films came out, and Janet Maslin, the first line of her review of this film is, several of the characters in Dune are psychic, which puts them in the unique position of being able to understand what goes on in the movies. That gives you a sense of how impenetrable this
is. Well, the one thing I remember about it was Sting had a shaved cat in it.
Yeah.
And that's the only image that has really stayed with me. Of course, it was a cult novel. That's one
right.
reason it was so
hotly anticipated.
But a good director.
Novel.
And so this is right. kind of what you think of David Lynch films. So you wonder sometimes how a bad film goes wrong, you know, in some way. I mean, how a film in the hands of what should be a good director goes so terribly wrong.
Right. And I remember one of the things with this film was the language that was used in the novel, which, you know, some things you can get away with on the page that really don't translate to the screen. And that ended up being one of the things that I remember is just the way that the character spoke was so bizarre and difficult to understand.
Let's stick with sci-fi. A listener who picked Troll 2.
My name is Barry Pemberton. I'm from Raleigh. My favorite bad movie is Troll 2.
They're eating her. And then they're going to eat me. Oh, my God.
It's an endearing train wreck that'll make you laugh at all of the wrong things, especially the scene where the child urinates on the food to prevent his family from eating it and turning into vegetables.
Listen to it. I must do it.
There we go.
Okay, so I have never seen this film. I hope the Cinema Overdrive folks at the Colony are listening to this show because we need to have that screened sometime soon. But, you know, Brian is not the only person who listed this as a guilty pleasure. A lot of people
love Troll 2.
Mentioned Troll 2. So I would really like to see it, and especially now that I've heard that amazing clip. I can only imagine that scene.
Well, how much of this has to do, especially in sci-fi, with the sort of great, like wondering whether or not they were in intentionally arch and kind of meta or not, and sort of the films that occupy that kind of gray area.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to answer that. I mean, I think it's fair to say that for something like Ed Wood, I mean, there was no budget for artfulness. And, you know, so I think you can feel, you know, a little bit like he was doing the best he could with the tools he had available to him, which was, you know, like a cigar and, you know, like a little bit of fog that he figured out how to create. But in other films that are kind of larger budget, and I don't know anything about Troll 2. I'm no Troll 2 expert yet. But, you know, I think sometimes we enjoy laughing at people's failures. I mean, that's the kind of schadenfreude in some ways that drives, I think, some of these pleasures that we have in watching bad films that did not set out intentionally to be bad.
Well, Dune had too much money. It was exactly the opposite problem. And I think once your budget begins to inflate and you say, well, I can do anything, you know, you're bound to go down the wrong road.
And we kind of like that. I mean, we like to see sometimes people get put in their places. And so that, no doubt, is part of the laughability.
Do you think David Lynch wakes up in the middle of the night afraid that he's still making Dune?
He probably does.
Or do you acknowledge it even and say, no, no, it's not what you think. It's not what you – you know what? I'm still stuck on this. If it's a flying saucer – then how is it shaped like a cigar?
Because in the early UFO reports, there was a conflict, you know, in the late 1940s, whether a UFO was shaped like a pie plate or whether it was shaped like a cigar.
So, Frank, my question is, how many UFOs have you seen?
Fact-checking, none of them that look like cigars. They all look like saucers. Fact-checking Ed Wood continues at Movies on the Radio today. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. There's more ahead. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Movies on the Radio today with Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State, and Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. And today we're talking about your guilty pleasures, movies that you would rather not say you like, but that we're forcing you to admit publicly that you like them anyway. And Laura, actually, this one is yours. That is music from the film soundtrack from the film Duplicate.
Yes, well, it's no secret that I love Bollywood movies, and certainly a lot of them I would, you know, would compare to anything on the world cinema stage. But there are bad Bollywood movies too.
What?
Yes, strange to say, this one stars Shah Rukh Khan, by some metrics the most popular movie star on earth, and he plays a person who has an exact double, his duplicate. Bollywood movies often have people that look exactly the same, and there's never any explanation for it. Perhaps there's some source in Hindu mythology. But anyway, there's a lovable chef named Bablu who is the exact duplicate of an underworld kingpin named Manu, and they end up impersonating each other. There are a lot of comedy songs. And then eventually, Bablu, through his innocence and good heart, he's so nice to the henchmen. He doesn't kill them for their mistakes. He says everyone makes mistakes, and he asks them to be remembered to their mothers, and he respects the mall because, you know, a good man should respect women. So all of the bad guys, henchmen, kind of turn against him because they see there's a better way that they can be reformed by his
nice
happiness. Yes. So, yes, Duplicate is one of those movies. In fact, I just watched it last night because there's such a wonderful excuse to do so.
So now what's horrible about it? I mean, it's
well,
the
there's
a
lot of
a little
very silly comedy. Okay. There is falling down.
Yeah.
But that's typical of a Bollywood film, right? Is that the comedy is a little over the top?
Not necessarily. I know. Marcia's going to be critical,
you
and
don't
I'm
like
going
Bollywood
to resist.
And you do. So that part we get. Okay, so what is it about it that even though you think to yourself, gosh, this is not quite, you know, like the quality isn't here, that you just can't take your eyes off?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the acting in it. Shah Rukh Khan and Juhi Chawla, who is the actress who acts opposite him, they have such great chemistry together, and they're very charming and funny. I mean, it's a romantic comedy as well as a, you know, more straightforward comedy, and it's just, it's fun to watch. It's undemanding, but it's not what you would call an intellectual movie.
Well, we're going to get to kind of the intersection of sci-fi and adventure here when we get to our next clip. This one, a lot of folks chose this one as well.
My name is Regina Williams. I live in Durham, North Carolina. My favorite bad movie is Howard the Duck.
This is unreal. I mean, it can't be.
Thanks.
You're not really a duck.
My favorite scene is when they're in a diner and they're ordering breakfast, and she orders for Howard, and he gets served like bacon and eggs, and he flips out when he sees the eggs on the plate.
What? You ordered your specials. What's wrong?
This will mean the extinction of all existing life forms.
You haven't even tasted it yet.
What do you think? I'm into cannibalism or something?
Hey, are we like all in the same discussion here?
I'll give you a hint, doll. What's white, ovoid, and always reminds me of my birthday? The eggs. Get them out of here.
So somebody just collected a bunch of jokes, put a guy in a duck suit, and said, let's make a movie. And that somebody was George Lucas.
I mean, I remember when this film, the advertising campaigns, I remember that duck everywhere on TV and in the previews and on posters. And I mean, I haven't seen this film since it came out, which I actually do think I saw it in the theaters. But this is another one I had fun looking up a review for. This is Karen James in The Times. Howard the Duck opens today at Lowe's Astor Plaza and other theaters. Choose the part that suits your taste. But this is a case where half a movie, either half, is apt to be better than the whole.
Well, it was based on a comic book, is that
yes.
not?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that supposedly has a certain amount of box office indestructibility.
Well, and also, I mean, I think some of the over-the-topness, I mean, that's not a film that's trying to be serious, clearly. I mean, it's meant to be fun, but there's films that are meant to be fun that have a little bit more art than others. And I remember that one thing about this film is that it was very unartful.
Well, that was what I was getting to earlier. It's like you have to make up your mind where you're going to go with this film. Is this thing, is it Airplane?
Right.
Where you're just, every joke is about Hollywood and about this kind of adventure film.
Right.
Or not. And Howard the Duck kind of occupied that middle space,
yes,
it seemed
I agree.
To me. It did come out of the Marvel comic books. It was meant to be an animation. And then apparently some contractual obligation required live action. And so they ended up with a guy in the duck suit. And it was crazy. One kind of wild moment, of course, in the film is when Howard's leaving his home on his other planet. He does pass what appears to be his mother in the bathtub. That's another weird moment in
this
film.
That's weird.
That's all very weird.
There's a lot of weird.
Ordinarily on Movies on the Radio, we hear from you, and then we talk to you and pre-record these. But we do have a live call right now, and Craig, who is on the line in Raleigh. Hello, Craig.
Hey, how are you, Frank? Nice to be online. Thank you.
Your guilty pleasure. Tell us about it.
Joe versus the Volcano. My wife and I absolutely love it. And I don't think we can really tell many family members and friends about it. But
this is so tell us a little bit about it. What's bad about it? And then why do you love it?
Oh, it's camp. It's overacting. There's Lloyd Bridges playing a nutty doctor where he talks about him having a brain cloud. He works in this horrible, depressing place. Terrible accents by Meg Ryan all through it, who plays multiple characters. This is spoiler stuff, I guess.
No, nobody's going to see this.
Favorite thing is drinking orange soda. But Tom Hanks playing the ukulele with a huge moon in the sky. It is so romantic and sweet, and yet I don't think a lot of the critics and my friends and relatives actually gut it the way we did. But a lot of the lines have ended up in our daily lexicon. Brain cloud. We use that all the time.
Especially when I go to the movies. Well, thanks, Craig. That was great. Marcia?
Yeah, well, I mean, I just was wondering. I was thinking to myself, so is it that it's so bad that he and his wife have created this great pleasure and all these inside jokes that grow out of it? And then that becomes a source of pleasure versus really liking the film. And that line, I guess, is a little bit fuzzy here.
Well, I think family language is actually a really important thing.
Right.
That if you watch this with people and then, you laugh over certain lines and then you start to share them in your family, it becomes your family folklore.
Kind of creates a culture. Well, juvenile humor is also a kind of a... one of the ways in which we feel guilty about a film that otherwise might be okay. Let's listen to this listener.
My name is Mike Fetty, and I'm from Gibsonville, North Carolina. And my guilty pleasure movie is Team America, World Police. It's a satire. Actually, it's a musical. Terrorist, your game is through, 'cause now you have to answer to America. And they offend everybody equally. And it's done with puppets, the whole thing. And there's even sex scenes with puppets in it. And they lampoon governments. They lampoon Hollywood celebrities. But I think the thing that I like about it the best is every time they go to save somebody, they end up destroying the town. Like they destroy some of the parts of Paris that are most famous, like the Louvre, trying to stop a terrorist attack. So they stop a small terrorist attack, but they destroy important parts of the city.
Your plans are over.
Bonjour, everyone. Don't worry. Everything is boom. We stopped the terrorists.
Right after my wife and I watched it, we said, we can't tell anybody we watched it.
There it is, Team America.
Well, I mean, and this is, of course, Trey Parker and Matt Stone of South Park fame. And, you know, they have a lot of crass, irreverent, really immature things in their films. But as this caller pointed out, they're getting at some very, very real things in our culture. And they're doing it in this way that has this broad kind of base appeal. But, I mean, I laugh, too. I mean, this is I mean, it's definitely a film that you can, you know, kind of crack up during. It's very, you know, it's kind of low kind of sense of humor on the one hand. But then I think it's important, you know, kind of ideas on the other hand.
Well, puppets are above criticism. It's not like you say, well, Meg Ryan was doing all those terrible accents. How could she do that? I mean, you can't criticize a puppet in
puppets
the same
having
way.
Sex is not above. As a matter of fact, I think this was a film that they had a hard time. If I remember correctly, they had a hard time getting an R rating.
Yeah,
I think
it was X rated.
I think Kirby Dick talks about that in this film is not yet rated.
Well, you know, the other thing is, too, that sometimes the crass humor. I mean, one of the things I've thought about, especially in their humor as it's used in South Park, is that it creates in your own mind this question that you should be asking, that satire should do. And you say to yourself, gosh, should I be laughing? That's really serious. Yeah, our war on terrorism is causing more destruction up in in areas of life that we would like to preserve than it is in saving us. And so that's a serious question. So you really call – I mean, I think it's the art of satire raised to its highest level in some ways.
Yeah, and I mean, I think documentaries tell one – you know, are one way of addressing those kinds of issues. But when you watch – I mean, this film is going to reach people that would never go see a documentary about America's war against terror, right? So there is something that clicks. I think, in the mind, even if you're laughing at something and you're coming to it because it's, you know, you think it's going to be South Park.
And just watching puppets have sex. I could watch that all day. I'm sorry. Puppet sex is, for me, the reason I go to the movies.
Really? I'm covering my eyes on the radio.
That's going to come back to haunt you, Frank. That line is going to come back.
Can retweet that. We should say, by the way, David Lynch says that he's taken his name off the credits.
Did he just Twitter?
He tweeted us, and then he said, and Frank, by the way, I'm shocked about your relationship with puppets. This is all from David Lynch, so I'm glad he's listening. Apparently he's removed his credits, said it was not his movies, disavowed it. There you go. That's the David Lynch thing. So action films, another important part of, those closet films that we watch and disavow.
My name is Susie Dieter, and I live in Hillsboro, and my guilty movie pleasure is Con Air. Nicolas Cage has the worst Southern accent to ever grace a movie screen.
Oh, no. What the hell you think you're doing?
But the dialogue is smart and funny. The Steve Buscemi character, he played the really creepy, killed a lot of people person. And after they took over the plane and they were dancing to It's a Sweet Home Alabama by Leonard Skinner. And they're dancing around. It's playing on the loudspeaker, and they're all dancing around. And he turns to Nicolas Cage and says,
"He finds irony. Bunch of idiots dancing on a plane to a song made famous by a band that died in a plane crash."
What I like about it is it really is smart and funny dialogue in the middle of a funny action movie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, movies can be fun, right? That's one of the reasons we like doing it. I remember seeing Snakes on a Plane. If you remember, that's another bad, funny plane.
You went to see Snakes on a Plane?
At the Durham Drive-In, before the Durham Drive-In closed.
Okay.
And it was so much fun because nobody was there because they thought they were going to see a masterpiece. You were there to have fun and to laugh, and that's a gift sometimes. And so this Con Air is kind of like that.
Well, and another film in that category might be Air Force One, which my daughter says, don't ever say, you know, that's a guilty pleasure, because it's really a great movie.
Yeah.
With a sort of kick-ass president of the United States played by Harrison Ford. And it's just totally fun.
Here's the thing. How do actors get away with the bad accents? I mean, going back to Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins, what was that? thing, this kind of
terrible
Cockney Rhode Island
thing. Sure, it's,
can't they that they can fix?
I think it totally has to do with, you know, they hire a dialogue coach and an accent coach, but it's for somebody who's kind of famous and powerful. And if somebody says, "Well, I've worked hard enough at this, I'm done.
This is my Southern accent, y'all."
Bonnie and Clyde, one of the worst Southern accent movies ever made. Yeah. I find it unwatchable now for that reason.
Marcia, we're going to hear from a listener about Xanadu, but I understand that this, if you were to have a guilty pleasure,
this is on my list of many, But yeah, Xanadu is, of course, the 1980 film with Olivia Newton-John, and I still have my record that I got when this film came out, and I will pull it out, and I will play it, and I will sing every word.
You can sing every word,
every
can't
song.
You?
So, but I'm glad someone else is going to talk about
it. Yeah, if you don't remember, here it is.
I am Skip Alzheimer. And I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. And my favorite bad movie is Xanadu. Out 1980 when I was just 13, and I saw it twice in the theaters, and it is bad. I've watched it as an adult, but there's something about it. It just kind of typifies the 1980s vibe of bad movie making, very elaborate, potentially cocaine driven. I would say the one scene that I love watching over and over and over again is the opening of the club Xanadu, which is this kind of roller disco slash Studio 54 knockoff.
Kid, can you imagine it?
Imagine what?
A bandstand right over there in that corner. And a big band like in the 40s.
No. Bandstands went out with run-in boards. Over there, a great rock and roll band. This is the 80s.
It was before cable television really took off and before VHS took off. And so it was this magical time where you kind of locked in some of this entertainment. And it just sticks with you.
Yeah. And Marcia was dancing and singing.
Yeah. Dancing and singing. Roller skating. ELO. Gene Kelly. Olivia Newton-John. I mean, this film has it all. It has it all. And I will watch it anytime, anywhere. I think it's fantastic. It is so much fun. And you know what? It's a period piece. It is 1980. And that's another thing that's great about it, even if it is, really bad.
But it was not a time when there were a lot of musicals on screen. And I think that's what contributed to its bad reputation, is that it was so out of step with the zeitgeist.
Well, that's one of the things that could make a bad movie good for you, is that it does place you in time. If you were coming of age, if that music meant something to you, or just looking at it now as an artifact, as a documentary of the stuff that was going on in that period, the way the club looked, Gene Kelly looking old, all of that. And I suppose that could obviously take us back to Elvis Presley.
I'm Carrie Eddins. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. And my favorite guilty pleasure movie is Blue Hawaii, starring Elvis Presley.
Night and you and blue Hawaii.
There's probably more or less no plot, but the whole story is Elvis has come home to his family home in Hawaii. He is getting pressured by his parents to go to work for, I believe, a pineapple company in Hawaii. And he doesn't want to do that, and he instead decides to become a tour guide.
Yes, the most gorgeous wahinis on Waikiki are taking lessons from Elvis when he gets a job guiding gals with more than scenery on their minds.
And so really, it's just kind of a giant postcard for Hawaii. Elvis is very charismatic. He's charming, even when he's being awkward. I mean, just by saying Elvis Presley, doesn't that just make you want to watch it?
This magic night of nights with you.
Oh, yeah. Blue Hawaii, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, Elvis, sadly, was in general not very well served by his film career. I mean, he was such a great singer and such an important cultural figure. But Colonel Parker wanted him to have a certain kind of image on screen, and it was at odds with the dynamism of his music career.
But I think, as Carrie pointed out, I mean, there are a number of stars, and Elvis is just a great example, that, you know, people went to those movies because they wanted to look at Elvis, and they wanted to hear him sing a few songs, and who cares about the rest of it? This was about Elvis. So I kind of love that there's, like, it transcends, it doesn't matter the plots. Right. I mean, I remember watching these on television growing up. They were terrible, but it was great to watch Elvis.
Well, that's it. I mean, Hard Day's Night didn't pretend to have a plot either. And the whole point was you were watching The Beatles. And if that's what you cared about, then of course it's great. I mean, there they are in other situations and, you know, sort of in costume. It does make you wonder what would happen if you allowed those performers to really act and play roles, even if they were limited, what they could do if you kind of channeled them well.
You would probably be very disappointed is probably the truth. I mean, I don't know, but...
And it would be the source of a whole other show.
And certainly people like David Bowie and Mick Jagger who have done dramatic films.
Right.
I mean, you would see them as a curiosity, but not perhaps, you know, as part of your musical.
But they tried. I mean, they tried to. Obviously, they had much more control over what they were doing than Elvis did.
Right.
But they also, you know, tried to do serious films.
My guest this hour, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State, Laura Boys, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. And we are talking about your guilty pleasures on Movies on the Radio. There is more ahead. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys are with me to talk about your guilty pleasures for this edition of Movies on the Radio. And joining us now by phone is Leanna in Durham with her guilty pleasure. Hello, Leanna.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me, Frank.
Okay. Nobody's listening. Tell us all about it.
Just us.
I have to say that in casual conversations when I tell friends that I love Dodgeball, a true underdog story, people literally are aghast. I think it goes back to the fact that I grew up in the 80s in West Virginia, and we were forced to play dodgeball every single day in PE class. But there's something about this story of Ben Stiller's Jim facing off against Vince Vaughn's Jim, and they decide to settle the score by playing in a dodgeball tournament. I mean, it's just... I'm reduced to giggles the entire way through. And my favorite scene is when Patches O'Houlihan, the guy who's the dodgeball legend, is in a wheelchair pitching chains and bolts at them and screaming, dive, dodge, duck. I don't know.
Well, Patches O'Houlihan, the dodgeball legend, is enough to sell me.
Oh, yeah.
Well, don't you just see Ben Stiller was always the last picked in gym? You just know that.
Well, and you know, dodgeball was, I grew up in the dodgeball generation. It was the meanest of those sports. I mean, just in terms of team picking and then in terms of what you did. So I get the anti-nostalgia aspect of this.
Thanks, Leanna. Talking about your guilty pleasures, corny romantic tearjerker movies, also an important part of this story.
My name is Janice Brooks. I'm from Graham, North Carolina. My favorite bad movie is What a Girl Wants. I like What a Girl Wants because I think it's a good romantic story, kind of that love conquers all theme where her parents were in love and somebody broke them up, and then 17 years later they're able to come back together in the end of the movie.
I love you, Daphne. I love you. I'm so sorry. I wouldn't change you. I wouldn't change anything about you. I wouldn't change one hair on your head. Not for anything.
I love you, Dad.
And they have several musical sequences. There's one at a party where Daphne's love interest does a James Brown song, and I don't think anybody can really do James Brown songs. And I really love the scene, but I hate it, so I kind of watch it like I watch horror movies with my hands over my eyes.
Oh, yeah. This is another one I haven't seen, but may not.
Yeah, I've not seen either.
No, me neither. I keep making marks here to go to my Netflix queue as soon as I get home.
And block it?
No, absolutely. Let me tell you, last time someone recommended Attack the Block, which I immediately went home and watched, and it's awesome. So take these recommendations seriously,
okay,
listeners.
All right, well, here's another classic, Dirty Dancing. Let's hear what these listeners have to say.
My name is Mary Stevens. I'm from Lillington, North Carolina, and my favorite bad movie is Dirty Dancing.
Now I
I love this movie because it has a great North Carolina connection. I think it has some social ideas that are worth exploring, and I love the dancing in the movie. But it is still a very bad movie. My favorite scene in the movie is when Baby is learning how to dance on the log and balance. It's a really kind of sweet, simple scene, and there's no dialogue between the characters. I think that's very well done.
Most important thing to remember in lifts is balance. I got it now.
Dirty Dancing.
Yeah, so I have to say, the number one actor mentioned in my responses to this query was Patrick Swayze. Over and over and over and over again. People love the bad Patrick Swayze acting in many, many Red Dawn came up all the time.
Point
Dirty
Blank.
Dancing. And I didn't even know this. One of my friends said, oh, Dirty Dancing, Havana Nights. Apparently there was another one made down the line. But yeah, people love that movie.
And I think this is right. I saw this French movie called Heartbreakers, in which this guy breaks up couples for a living, and he does this in one case because the heroine is so obsessed with Dirty Dancing, and he learns the whole Dirty Dancing routine in order to break her up from her fiance.
That's perfect.
So it had a seminal effect on Hollywood, and
yes.
It's gone.
Well, it was a huge hit. The soundtrack was
a huge hit.
This was a high impact film when it came out.
Well, comedies that are kind of wacky also are on folks' list. Let's listen to this.
My name is Valerie Glassman. I live in Durham, North Carolina. And my favorite bad movie is Weekend at Bernie's. In my house when I grew up on Long Island, we would watch this movie all the time when it was on TV. And I like it because it's pretty ridiculous.
What kind of a host invites you to his house for the weekend and dies on you? Why would he do this, huh? I mean, he had everything. House, cars, women. This is tragic.
I don't understand why he couldn't wait until Monday to kill himself.
One of my favorite scenes in the movie is when the mobster is in the house and his wife comes in through another door and she wants to have some words with Bernie. So she asks Richard and Larry where Bernie is and they say he's upstairs in the bedroom. So she storms upstairs and she's up there for quite a while. And then she comes back down singing and humming and she's really in a good mood. And Richard and Larry ask, how were things up there? And she says,
never been better.
And just to say that she had a really good time with Bernie, not realizing that he's been dead the whole time.
Yeah, he's a puppet.
So we haven't really talked about this, but a lot of these films that we're talking about today are from the 80s. And
half of the films on our list are from the 80s.
And so the question is, having not done a very careful analysis of the data on the matter, is it because there were so many really bad films made in the 80s, but that so many people saw them because of the nature of film going in the 1980s? Or is it because that's the way our demographics skew? I mean, it's just a very interesting coincidence that so many of these films are from the 80s. And by the way, that film, a lot of it was filmed on the North Carolina coast.
That's right. That was one of the points she made about it. But the other, so that you raise a good question, whether or not that's sort of on the scope. That's when folks were seeing movies in our demographic. Because do older movies kind of get a pass? They're just older films, and sort of there's parts of them that we know aren't going to.
Well, I think the ones that you see, is the cream that has risen to the top. I'm sure there were lots of laughable movies. Lame serials. Crash Corrigan and the Undersea Kingdom and many, Oeters, Westerns, with the same plot over and over again.
You just haven't seen them.
Because there's very little motivation to see them.
We should do a show on guilty pleasures of the 1910s next month.
So we'll do a series. We'll do it for a whole month. Well, okay, so we've got a listener on the line, actually, who wants to tell us about his guilty pleasure. His name is Aaron. He's in Greensboro. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What's your guilty pleasure?
My guilty pleasure is the classic movie Waterworld.
Oh, yeah. Now, there's another bloated over budget film, right?
Completely over budget script, director changes. It was a flop in the box office, but I just love that movie. I actually still have the soundtrack. I'm probably the only person who actually went out and bought the soundtrack so much.
Wow.
And my favorite scene is what really got me, that opening scene of the movie where you have Kevin Costner on this really awesome boat where he needs to get the plant or his little bag out of the water, and he's racing two jet skis, and he jumps on his boat, hits all these gears, these levers, all of a sudden all the sails come out and he gets all this speed and just comes racing across. The music sounds, this opening scene, it's fantastic, and then the rest of the movie just bombs.
Yeah.
After that, just gets worse and worse and worse, and there's a scene near the end where they drop a flare in the middle, right down the shaft on the big oil tanker, and you see the guy who's been floating around in this oil for years, and he just says, "Oh, thank God." And that's how you feel when you watch it.
Thank you, Aaron from Greensboro. Thanks, Aaron.
And I remember when this film came out, the press had so much fun decimating Kevin Costner. I mean, this is one of those Schadenfreude moments in the culture where everyone just piled on this bloated film and narcissism and terrible this and that. And it became like sport. It was like...
Well, they were so mad at him for winning all those Oscars for Dances with Wolves.
Right.
They were just getting back at him. They felt that he wasn't worthy.
All right. Another film from the 1980s. Let's listen.
My name's Bill Floyd. I'm from Hillsboro. My favorite bad movie is Tough Guys Don't Dance. It was directed by the writer Norman Mailer, and just about every line in it is howlingly bad. It's Ryan O'Neal having an existential meltdown where he keeps spinning around and going, "Oh, God, oh, man, oh, God, oh, man." That's something that sometimes The Daily Show and people will use when they're trying to show somebody having a flip out.
My husband is having an affair with your wife. I don't think we should talk about it. Unless you're prepared to kill them.
Oh, man. Oh, God. Oh, man. Oh, God. Oh, man. Oh, God. Oh, man. Oh, God. Oh, man. Oh, God.
It's this twisted murder mystery that you can't, the plot's almost impossible to follow. It's just hilarious to watch. I mean, it's original. I'll give it that. And the actors seem to have a lot of fun, with the exception of Ryan O'Neal, who's pretty typically terrible.
The Tough Guys Don't
Dance. I see that the soundtrack was from one of those Ed Wood movies.
Yeah, right. Good repurposing of 50s material. I mean, these are two huge stars. Norman Mailer is this huge author, and I had never even heard of this film until...
I think drug use may also have been
I
involved.
Mean, but, you know, the Vincent Canby in The Times wrote that Mr. Mailer is not a born filmmaker, and that just kind of, that's the nail.
No, it was brilliant. People miss the literary value of this. It was ingenious. Oh, God. Oh, man. Oh, God. You see the existential dilemma that's being expressed. It's a crappy film.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it's so frustrating. The films that are aching to sort of bring home a social message or even a deeper message, and you can feel it kind of urging its way to the screen, and they never make it.
Well, it's like bad poetry. There's nothing worse than a bad poem, right?
Yeah.
That somebody's writing very earnestly, and you get that sense for some of these more personal projects. I'm guessing this Mailer project was very much a personal project. He really wanted to make this movie, and then it's like, ooh, it's the bad poem.
We should talk about, we got a tweet asking about the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So this talks about kind of cult films that are so bad they're good to everybody for all time.
Yeah.
I mean,
but no one should apologize for liking Rocky Horror.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, that camp value that people take that kind of, I mean, Ed Wood is like that. I mean, many people adore Ed Wood films. I mean, I think they're great fun to watch. And so, I mean, Rocky Horror Picture Show has a whole other life of its own. That's a whole other show.
Right. So I think this may be the go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and it reminded me, I was thinking those 70s disaster films, a lot of people brought up, you know, Airport and Earthquake and Poseidon Adventure. I mean, those are so much fun to watch, but they're campy.
That's the thing. And you just don't know whether you should admit that you like them. Well, here's the one that just wins the award for can't tell whether it's over the top or just great. Let's listen.
My name is Tim Kirkman, and I'm a writer-director living in Los Angeles. And my guilty pleasure is Mommy Dearest, the 1981 biopic of the Hollywood actress Joan Crawford, which was based on her daughter Christina's book. There's this scene where Joan is screaming at her daughter about the wire hangers. It's the perfect combination of ambitious scale plus glamour plus Hollywood plus the fact that it was a true story and an over-the-top but really a spot-on performance by Faye Dunaway as Joan Crawford.
No wire hangers! What's wire hangers doing in this closet when I told you no wire hangers ever?
There's a sense that everyone who was making this movie was really committed to this idea, and it just somehow didn't quite turn out the way they probably wanted it to be.
What do I get? A daughter! Who cares as much about the beautiful dresses I give her as she cares about me?
It seems like it's just exaggerated melodrama, and it's delicious. I mean, it's so much fun to watch.
Answer me! I buy you beautiful dresses, and you treat them like they were some dish rag.
There we go.
Well, of course, Christina Crawford, who wrote this book, was settling scores.
Yes.
So a lot of this over-the-top emotion is in her book.
Well, and I think part of the reaction to this film is this is a really serious subject, right? I mean, this relationship that's, you know, abusive and very toxic, and then it's handled in this such an insane way. And, you know, on the one hand, it's very, very funny by virtue of the fact that it's so crazy. On the other hand, it's so depressing. I mean, it's such a sad and it's so one-sided and it's such a twisted relationship that, I mean, I think that's part of the reason people take, such pleasure from this is another great camp classic film. People love watching this and talking about the wire hangers.
And well, in fact, I once dressed up for Halloween in a 1940s fur coat with a wire hanger. It was one of my better costumes.
There you go.
Of a Hollywood writer who says it was over the top and spot on. I mean, what does that, what does that mean?
And
I mean,
delicious.
And delicious.
That it deserves that kind of treatment.
Maybe. Because could we talk about Faye Dunaway for just a moment?
Because
it seems to me that every one of her performances is kind of that. I always feel like when she's on the screen, we should have, we should have a little subtitle that follows her that says actress. Because she seems to be acting all the time. She really thought about how to make this accent and that face.
Yes, she has a very particular affected style. And I do think, when this came out, all the talk was about her performance, wasn't it? Everybody was like, oh, and Faye Dunaway is Joan Crawford, but turned up a notch.
That's because the wardrobe and the hair and the makeup actually made her look kind of like Joan Crawford as well.
Right. And as someone who, I love Joan Crawford films of the, 30s and 40s and beyond, really. But, to see her, this ties into the whole everything, wanting to see behind the veil of Hollywood and to kind of, the schadenfreude of, wanting to see your idols kind of torn down. And this was absolutely this vicious attack against.
I have this little personal story. When this right around when this movie came out, I met Myrna Loy, and I was doing some writing at the time, and I said I was right. I was introduced. Oh, this is Laura. She's a writer, and she looked at me and she said, "I certainly hope you're not writing about your mother." only contact I
mothers
had
beware.
With Myrna Loy.
Oh, I wish we had more time. But Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Frank.
Great
you
fun.
Can find out more. Oh, next month,
yes.
Hitchcock. I don't have much time, but your favorite Hitchcock movie. You can hear more. Go to our website, stateofthings.org, and we will be very active on social media trying to get your attention about that. Thank you so much for listening to The State of Things on North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.